This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. This is the podcast which gives you the need-to-know info other news programmes don't have time for. It's where you'll get the finer details on the big issues of the day. Before we start this week's show, I'd like to ask a favour. Chances are you downloaded this podcast on your phone or tablet. It's probably in your hand as I speak. So, can you just scroll up or down on your page and make sure you've clicked the subscribe button? Done it? Thank you. Not done it? I've got all day. I'm just sitting here thinking big thoughts. Well, I tried, and the reason podcasts like us are so obsessed with the subscribe button is that it gives us an extra boost in the popularity contest that is the podcast charts, and at the end of the day, we just want to be liked. Another thing which can help is giving us a rating on your podcast provider. Tots2, Horseman, Kevin B, Xandrol and Gladys, thank you all for your recent reviews. We do read them, and they're much appreciated. But look, enough demands. Let's start this week's show.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
11 months ago, Donald Trump took office as the 45th president following a rollicking campaign in which he promised in all manner of ways to make America great again. And the circus kept rolling this year as President Trump tweeted his feelings about matters of high policy and low ratings to the world, and as some of his closest advisers were being grilled on Capitol Hill. For journalists, that's a lot of fun. But the big ring antics aside, what has President Trump actually achieved in his first year? In this week's programme, we're going to hear some of the main promises Donald Trump made on the campaign trail and ask, has he done what he said he was going to do?
On this vote, the ayes are 51, the nays are 48. The Senate recedes from its amendment and concurs in H.R. 1 with further amendment. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is passed.
Earlier this week, Donald Trump scored a very big legislative victory as the U.S. Senate approved what is arguably the most significant overhaul of the U.S. tax system in more than three decades. To explain just how big a deal this is, here's Donald Maron, Director of Economic Policy Initiatives at the Urban Institute think tank in Washington, D.C.
The enactment of this tax bill is an enormous political success for President Trump and for Republicans in Congress. As you may remember, earlier this year, they had a fairly dramatic political failure in their efforts to undo the health reform that happened under President Obama. That had been a singular feature of the president's campaign and of Republicans in Congress. So now they're actually putting essentially a big win on the board of doing a major change to the tax code. President Trump, as a candidate, campaigned on a much larger tax cut, which perhaps isn't surprising. So the tax cut we're seeing enacted is about one quarter the size of what he spoke about at the time. But the president says this is going to be the biggest tax cut in history. There's a question about how you measure that. We in the analytic community think it's natural to compare the size of the tax cut to the overall size of the economy. And by that metric, this tax cut is nowhere near the biggest. Ronald Reagan in 1981 had one that was four or five times larger. It's still significant, but nowhere near the largest in history. Now, the big asterisk on all of this, though, is that if you look at the polling around the tax bill, this is not particularly popular. It is not something that's resonated yet broadly with the American people. You know, not a public opinion expert dude here, but this hasn't broken through with the broad public because a lot of the focus in practice of the tax bill is on the business side. I mean, the big winners under this plan are going to be multinational corporations. Multinationals will see their tax rate fall from 35% to 21%, and high-income folks who organize themselves as businesses. Individuals and households are going to see tax cuts as well. Around 80% of households are going to see some reduction. Someone in the middle of the income distribution is going to see their taxes go down about $900. So, meaningful tax cut for normal households for the first few years of this proposal. Key feature, though, being that a lot of the tax cuts for individual households expire after a few years.
Donald Maron. President Trump's business expertise, he claimed, was what made him the perfect candidate to run America's economy.
I will be the greatest jobs president that God ever created. I tell you that. We have people that aren't working. We have people that have no incentive to work. But they're going to have incentive to work. Because the greatest social program is a job. And they'll be proud, and they'll love it, and they'll make much more money than they would have ever made. And they'll be doing so well, and we're going to be thriving as a country. Thriving!
So how's all that going? Joining me to discuss the current state of the American economy and employment is Joseph Gagnon, Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. Can you remind us what Donald Trump's key campaign pledges were in terms of economic policy?
I think his number one issue was the trade deficit. He wanted to shrink that to get more jobs for Americans. He talked a lot about manufacturing jobs, about middle-class jobs. He also pledged to cut back on regulations. He felt that Democrats under President Obama were trying to put too much red tape on American businessmen to keep them, hold them down, and also cut taxes.
How far do you think it's possible to measure whether he's achieved his goals?
He really hasn't done much yet, but he is starting to make progress. I think on trade, the trade deficit is getting larger, actually, under his watch. So it's not progressing, but he is beginning to negotiate with other countries and put small barriers up here and there. I don't believe it's actually going to help the trade deficit, but it might help particular American businesses in certain areas. In terms of tax, well, they just got a big victory, and we'll see. I expect it will boost the economy next year. The regulatory changes so far have been really quite small and, again, wouldn't be expected to show up.
Is the same true of growth?
Yes, basically the economy has been growing a little bit above 2% now for several years. Unemployment rate has been coming down. Employment has been growing steadily throughout. You don't see any inflection point with the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, he's taken quite a lot of credit for job creation and growth during his presidency.
Yes, he said, before he was elected, the numbers were fake, and now that he's president, the numbers are real. But the numbers haven't changed. They're growing steadily and have been. It's quite amazing how steadily job growth has been for 7 or 8 years now.
Now, one of the things that people recollect from the election was the idea that Donald Trump would bring really high-profile manufacturing jobs back to key areas of the United States. Are those the kind of jobs that are being created?
Yes, to some extent they are. That manufacturing hasn't done too badly, and some of the other sectors of the economy that employ lower-wage people, less-skilled people, actually have done relatively better. The unemployment rate has fallen more for the low end. That's actually not unusual, though. As the late stages of recovery happens and employers are looking more and more for workers, it tends to push down into those with lower skills. And since we've been hiring up a lot for a long time now, they're reaching sort of the lower end of the wage distribution. And that's a normal phenomenon, but it seems to be happening.
And now the stock market has gone through the roof under Donald Trump. What are we to read into that?
Well, you know, around the world, stock markets are booming, and in many cases, they've risen more, in Europe in particular. And it's hard to say that Donald Trump caused that. So we think it's probably a global synchronized recovery for the first time in many years.
Now, a lot of the emphasis was put on trade deals, on altering the terms of trade deals to benefit American manufacturing jobs.
Insofar as you can do something about that in a year, has anything very much changed?
No, nothing has changed yet, but there are some initiatives afoot. The most noticeable one is the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. There's actually not a lot of scope there to get much really in the way of the trade deficit or jobs for America, because we actually have balanced trade with Canada, and Mexico has an overall deficit with the whole world, so they really don't have a lot of scope to buy more from America. So it's not the area where I think they would be winning gains, but they're certainly making efforts.
One last question, Joe. I mean, there used to be an enormous emphasis amongst Republicans on cutting the deficit. As I understand the tax changes, they're likely for the moment to increase the deficit. Does that mean the deficit no longer matters to anybody very much in America?
I don't know how he can forget about what I think on the economic side was his number one campaign promise, which was to fix the trade deficit. But certainly tax cuts are moving us in the wrong direction on the trade deficit, and I don't believe the actions they've taken so far, including on NAFTA, are going to help.
Joseph Gagnon of the Peterson Institute in Washington, D.C. Bill Clinton famously said, "It's the economy, stupid." But foreign affairs have a way of coming to find U.S. presidents. Thus, much of Donald Trump's first year has been dominated as much by matters abroad as those at home, from North Korean nukes to his team's alleged ties with Russia. But were those his foreign affairs priorities before the election? To remind us of what he said and what he has done is Leslie Vinjamuri, Associate Fellow at the Americas Programme at the international affairs think tank Chatham House.
Trump came in as the president who was going to put America first, and he had a fairly clear strategy for doing that. The first thing, of course, was to be sure that in every deal that he negotiated for America, that America's interests would come first and foremost. And the way to do that, in his mind, was to negotiate bilateral and not multilateral deals. But on the security side, he also wanted to play much harder ball. Remember, he came into office saying that he wouldn't necessarily support NATO, that he would expect America's NATO partners to really contribute in a much more significant way than they had in the past. He said he wasn't sure that he would continue to provide security for South Korea, for Japan, for really key security partners for America. He also then wanted to renegotiate and recast relations with Russia. He thought he was the leader who could really turn this relationship around, primarily by focusing on his own personal relationship with President Putin. And then he wanted to undo a number of deals. He wanted to undo the Iran nuclear deal because, of course, his hard line has been on Iran. He also wanted to extend a hand to traditional allies of the United States, so Israel and Saudi Arabia, that felt they hadn't really been given their fair share by President Obama.
What about hard power intervention? What line had he taken about America putting troops into places before he came into office?
Well, this is a president that wanted to reduce America's footprint in the Middle East, pull troops back. Really, the only place that America should exercise its hard power would be in those domains where America clearly has a national security interest at stake.
Okay, so now let's talk about the follow-through. How's he actually done?
This is the puzzling part. If you follow Donald Trump's tweets, if you listen to him speak, much of the rhetoric remains intact. He continues to say that America's interests must come first. But in any number of dimensions, in fact, many things have remained very much in place. So America's commitment to NATO remains fully intact. He's turned around on security, right? He's continuing to, he's forged a very strong relationship with the Japanese Prime Minister Abe. He has continued to reaffirm America's security commitment to South Korea. Of course, we have seen some very significant changes too. One of the first things that President Trump did was to pull the United States out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, remember that this is not only an economic strategy for engaging the United States and securing its influence in East Asia. It's also meant to be a geopolitical strategy, and it was seen as a way of managing the rise of China in the Asia region. And President Trump pulled America right out of that, and in doing so, I think, has undermined America's influence.
What about the Iran deal?
This president is a man who does not like to be seen not to be upholding his word, so I think it was very difficult for him to certify the Iran deal as he initially did. In the most recent round, of course, he chose not to do that. He turned to the U.S. Congress and he refused to certify the Iran deal. But in fact, what does that mean? It leaves it to Congress. And Congress, as we saw, decided last week not to reinstate sanctions against Iran. So he took a strategy that he frequently has taken, which is to rhetorically hold on to his commitments, but in practice, not much changes. We see this also potentially with the recent statement that America recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Nonetheless, President Trump signed the waiver, which meant that the embassy won't be moving anytime soon. And he also said, "We recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, but the status of Jerusalem must be determined through negotiations that include the Israelis and the Palestinians." That's not new. That's been America's stance for a very long time.
What's happened about U.S. troop commitments abroad? Have they, as he anticipated, been significantly reduced?
What we've seen is that his new Afghanistan strategy has been to keep troops in and to increase the number of troops on the ground. We also saw in Syria, right? Syria was the place that President Trump thought America had absolutely no business engaging. And his first use of hard power in this presidency was in response to the violation of an international humanitarian norm, that is, President Assad's use of chemical weapons. Instead of doing what he had said he would do, which would be not to respond, he launched 59 Tomahawk missiles.
Let's talk about some of the impacts of some of these policies. We've hinted a few of them, but let's go follow through with some of the others. What do you think the international community has made of Trump policy over the emergencies he's faced, the most obvious being North Korea?
I think different parts of the world have responded differently. If you speak to South Koreans, they're surprisingly unconcerned. The thing that's changing, and it was going to change regardless of who was president, was that the North Koreans have now got an ICBM, right? So now that weapon at some point is going to be put on that ICBM and it will be able to reach the continental United States. So the game has changed at the global level. Any president was going to have to deal with that. But the problem with this president is that the rhetoric is all over the map. And one day there's an offer of talks. The next day there's no offer of talks. Then there's an offer of talks with conditions. And of course, the president and his secretary of state, Tillerson, have had very different public statements on the matter. So it makes it very difficult for America to work with allies because nobody's quite sure what the line is. It's just simply mixed and uncoordinated messages. So as we saw in the national security strategy that came out on Monday, it's a fairly conventional Republican national security strategy. If you watch the president's speech, it's very different from the national security strategy. And so there's a gap even there. Nobody's quite sure who's running the ship.
Let's talk about Russia. What has he actually done over Russia?
Yeah, he absolutely came in wanting to forge a very strong relationship with President Putin. He sort of had an affinity, a personal affinity for this leader. And he thought that that personal affinity could change the entire quality and character of America's relationship with Russia. In fact, things have gotten worse between the United States and Russia during his time in office. Congress has pulled him right back in. They were never on side with this idea that Russia could be seen as a partner that America could work with. This president has had to sign additional sanctions against Russia despite his instincts and his desires. And the relationship has continued to deteriorate. It's gone nowhere in any of the directions that President Trump had hoped it would be.
Leslie Vinjamuri from Chatham House. Tony Blair's was education, education, education. Donald Trump's trio was...
Build that wall, 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 build that wall. Build that wall!
Illegal immigrants and criminal bad hombres were walking into America with ease. Not only was he going to send them all back home, but he was going to build a wall to stop them coming back, and Mexico was going to pay for it. In addition, he said that Muslims entering the United States would have to undergo extreme vetting. A revised version of that plan is in effect, pending the outcome of various court challenges. But has he delivered on his other pledges? Joining me is Dr. Marie Price of George Washington University, who is a migration expert and president of the American Geographical Society. Dr. Price, how's progress with the wall going?
Well, There hasn't been any change in the wall since President Trump, but there has been an active wall building since 1996. If you've ever been to the U.S.-Mexican border, whether you're on Texas or California, there's major infrastructure. Their walls, their drones, their border security. There are a few places in the Arizona desert that are very isolated where people do try to walk through, but they also risk their lives doing it because it's so inhospitable. So it is not a wide open border. It hasn't been for 30 years.
So in summary, there is only a wall insofar as there was a wall before.
Exactly.
Okay. What about the deportations? Are they up under President Trump?
So there have just been limited statistics for 2017, but it looks like 2017 will be on par with 2016, maybe even fewer deportations. So one thing that's important to keep in mind is that when Obama became president, he increased border security and increased the number of removals. So he had the distinction of removing more people from the United States than any other president. And Obama and the Democrats weren't really bragging about that because it was a fact that upset their Latino constituency. And then the Republicans wouldn't brag about it because it didn't fit their narrative that Obama was soft on immigration.
So what is the most significant thing President Trump has done about immigration?
Probably the most dramatic thing are two areas. One, undid the executive orders that Obama created. One was called DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
Which was a kind of, I don't know, a kind of pathway for some of them to citizenship.
Exactly. It no longer exists as a program. And then another order that was signed by Obama and was never implemented was DAPA, which would be Deferred Action for the Parents of American Citizens. We have birthright citizenship, so if you're born on U.S. soil, you're an American, but your parents might not be legally here. And so DAPA was tied up in the courts and never implemented, and that could have given a path to some regular status for over 2 million people.
Is it fair to say at the end of all this that although there's been an awful lot of rhetoric from President Trump about being tough on migration, the reality is that things pretty much, DACA apart, have stayed the same?
I would say there's been a lot more bark than bite. However, that bark can be very destructive because certainly amongst immigrants, there's a lot more fear. Also, especially with the Muslim ban, I think many Muslim immigrants also feel a heightened anxiety about their place in this society.
Now, of course, you're not a party political person in any way at all, but insofar as you observe the political effects of things, do you think that the fact that the bark is worse than the bite actually, nevertheless, is sufficient to make Trump and Republican supporters feel better because they feel that something is being done?
Right. And that's the power of the wall as an image. You know, you're doing something. You're building a wall. It looks like you're taking action. But consider this fact. Since 2007, so for the last 10 years, over half of the undocumented population that has come to the U.S. then didn't come by crossing the Mexican-U.S. border. They came by flying into the U.S. and overstaying their visa. So a wall is not even going to begin to address that population.
Dr. Marie Price from the American Geographical Society. Some powers that the U.S. president has are unsexy, but incredibly important.
I'm looking for judges, and I've actually picked 20 of them so that people would see. Highly respected, highly thought of, and actually very beautifully reviewed by just about everybody. But people that will respect the Constitution of the United States.
The justice system is the third branch of American government in which a president can leave a mark on American society. Last year's election presented the winner with the chance to nominate a new justice for the Supreme Court, but the president's influence on American justice runs much deeper. Here to tell me about Donald Trump's progress is Judge Shira Shendlin, a retired district court judge from New York. Judge, all presidents have a chance to nominate judges. How much latitude has President Trump had in terms of the numbers of vacant positions that he has to fill?
Well, he started out with maybe 140 or 150 vacancies, which is a little higher than usual. But throughout the course of a presidency, that will grow, because judges retire, judges die, judges resign, and there's always vacancies being created.
Now, he got his nomination for the Supreme Court judge through. Tell us a bit about the man who President Trump put in and the impact his appointment has had on the Supreme Court.
Right. Not so much, because remember, he replaced Justice Antonin Scalia, who was a very conservative justice. The new justice, Justice Gorsuch, I feel, and many people feel, is also very conservative, but it's a straight-up exchange. So nothing really has changed yet. The court is very ideologically split. People say it's 4-4, and then Justice Kennedy in the middle. That's not to say that sometimes a justice in the conservative bloc will vote with the liberals. Sometimes a justice in the liberal bloc will vote with the conservatives. But generally speaking, it's perceived as 4-4-1.
Now, I wouldn't presume to ask whether any of the others are looking not very well at the moment.
All right, I'll stay away from that too.
Okay.
Now, I will say, without commenting on their health, that Justice Kennedy has hinted that he is considering retiring at the end of next year. Considering.
And that would be a swing judge, and
Mr. Trump
would try to replace that by a conservative judge.
Oh, very much so. And that would shift the balance.
Now, it's the Supreme Court which gets all the publicity over here. But what about the other courts? How significant are those appointments?
Okay. So the lowest court here is called the U.S. District Courts. That's the trial courts. And that's where I sat. And there are a total of 677 district court judges throughout the United States. And frankly, the bulk of the work is done in the district courts, and their decisions are often final because the parties don't appeal to the intermediate appellate court or certainly to the Supreme Court. The next level is the courts of appeals, and they have a total of 179 judges. Now, those judges decide about 60,000 cases a year, but then the high court only decides 82 cases.
Who is President Trump looking to fill the vacancies in these lower courts?
This president, and probably most presidents, have looked to appoint people who maybe reflect their own views. It is not uncommon to do that. But I think other presidents have also had maybe more of a mix. This president seems to want all of his appointments to think in a certain way and to be pretty much of the same party.
If he does get most of his nominations through, what long-term impact do you think that would have on the American justice system?
The courts of appeals are really the key spot, that middle court that I mentioned, the one that decides the 60,000 cases, because very few go to the Supreme Court. And the trial court, the ones that don't go to appeal, are probably just disputes that don't have important impacts on society. So it's that middle court of appeals that's so important. And the question is, what is the majority makeup of that court? For example, when President Obama took office, only 4 of the 11 circuits had what we would call a liberal majority. By the time he left, 9 of the circuits had a liberal majority. I think President Trump's goal will be to shift it back. If that happens, we will see an impact in major issues such as employment law, climate change, affirmative action, voting rights, civil rights, just to name a few of the hot button issues that I think will be impacted by a major shift in the circuit courts.
Judge Shira Shendlin, we haven't covered everything in this program, but the pattern seems reasonably clear. It's been a year of gargantuan rhetoric, sometimes contradictory actual policies, some big changes, and some rowing back. On Monday, Turkey for you. But next Thursday, we'll be back asking if the Democratic Party has got over its traumatic defeat at last year's US elections and whether they're likely to win back power anytime soon. Till then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Richard Fenton Smith. Please let us know what you think about this podcast by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.